Blog Talk Radio.
Out there, thank you so much for joining us. I'm your host, John Robb. This is the Spence Radio Insight Edition, April the 30th, 2016. Thank you for listening, however, wherever, and whenever you listen to the show. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. Of course, you can subscribe to us on iTunes. There's a lot of other podcast sites that have us out there. So you find us, put us in your listening device. Whenever the show's over, boom, there you go. You get it right then and there. And that's all the shows that we have on here, which includes Crime and Science Radio, Story Blender, Beyond the Cover, One-on-One, and then Inside Edition. We have something for everybody. We have you covered. Today's show, we got 60 minutes coming on. We're waiting for our first guest to arrive. His name is Carl Brookings, and then we're going to be followed by Claire McIntosh, and we will get her on as soon as that comes up, about 10 o'clock Pacific time. In the meantime, I'm going to have to fill some time here waiting for Carl. He was a last-minute addition. We were supposed to have Betty Jean Craig on the show. She had to cancel at the last minute, and so Carl, publicist, said that he was going to fill in, and I'm going to email over real quick and see. But, yeah, as of right now, just waiting for him to get on. But let's talk about some of the things that we do have coming up. This Monday show is going to be extremely interesting on the Beyond the Cover, of course, hosted by me and also Jeff Ayers. And for those of you who have not listened to the show, Mondays is going to be extremely unique. We're going to do something a little bit different. Jeff and I have talked about this for quite some time. Beyond the Cover is a different kind of show. Yes, we have authors and we talk to them, we interview them. But we do it in kind of a little different way. But we also talk about everything that can be suspense, mystery, thriller, horror. That includes TV shows. That includes movies. That includes, you know, plays. I mean, anything that can be considered suspense, mystery, thriller, horror. I had to get a drink. We will discuss and we will talk about it. And this time we are debating Star Wars versus Star Trek, two of the biggest universes in sci-fi, of course, and everybody at least knows one or the other. Maybe you watch both, maybe you watch one or the other, but we are going to have two authors on, Chris Taylor, who has written a book with Star Wars, Greg Cox, who has written several books with Star Trek, and then, of course, Jeff and I pick sides. I will be with Chris, Jeff will be with Greg. And so we will basically discuss the universe of both of them, the characters, the creation, how things affect society, how you can see little nuances within both of them. You know, not only on the screen that you see, of course, Star Trek has a lot more on screen than Star Wars does. Star Wars has, of course, the seven movies that we all know. But Star Trek has not only the movies, but several TV show series. Of course, the original with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, and then you have The New Generation, you have The Voyager, The Deep Space Nine, and those. Star Wars has a couple series, too. They had The Clone Wars animated series, and I think they're getting into another one with this Rogue that's coming out, the Rogue One movie, which is going to come out later this year. And then, of course, they just had the major Force Awakenings, and Star Trek's going to have a new movie coming out. So we're going to pit those two together. It's going to be really fun because it's something that we've talked about doing for quite some time, and now we're able to get some experts on to be with us so we don't look a little ridiculous. But the other thing is that it's just something that we're able to do that's a little different. I mean, it's great that we're able to talk with authors and talk about their books, but there's so much more that goes into the realm of suspense, mystery, thriller, horror that we'd like to kind of get off that subject a little bit, and we like to expand ourselves out. Just like I tweeted out not too long ago, there's a music group called Dream Theater, and they just did a CD called The Astonishing. And what this is this is a two-hour, basically a two-hour story within a CD. I mean, they have created on their website characters. This is the first time I've ever seen, and I've seen one of the best concept albums I've ever listened to was Queensryche with Operation Mindcrime, and then they have Mindcrime 2. And that was a major series, and that was a major hit for them, Mindcrime was. And that's a story within the song, so when you read the lyrics, you'll almost be reading a book, and it's just in music form. I mean, you can kind of say it's like an opera. It's kind of like the metal opera that they talk about. Trans-Siberian Orchestra has been doing it now for years with their concept albums. I remember they have one, I think, The Christmas Attic and a couple others, and they tour all over, and that's a story. So you're physically seeing, and Dream Theater just did this with The Astonishing, and it's a two-hour story. And online, they have physically built, you can see the characters, their bio, the world, the whole nine yards that they have put together for this album. If you're a fan of Dream Theater and you're going to go see them on tour, just know also that they're only doing this album. You're not going to hear Pull Me Under. You're not going to hear anything from Images and Words. You're not going to hear any of that stuff. You're going to hear only this album. It's going to go from start to finish, and it's going to take you like a play all the way through it. And I think it's a great idea, but that's another way of telling stories. Of course, Prince, who just passed away, he was a tremendous storyteller with his music, and you could hear it in his lyrics, When Doves Cry, and of course he was in Purple Rain with that story. And that's just another way of telling stories. Of course, you know, we focus mainly on the books, but there are so many other ways to tell stories and to get stories to people that I don't know if people actually catch those mediums or not. But so that's kind of what we like to do with Beyond the Cover, is we like to kind of explore those things. And that's why we're doing the Star Wars, Star Trek. The other stuff is that, I don't know if you heard on our last Beyond the Cover too, is we had Meg Ruley on, and she was a literary agent. And so you were able to kind of, this is the first time we ever had a literary agent on. We did have an editor once from a book publisher. The name slips me right now. I'm terrible with names. But Meg Ruley is a high-level literary agent. A couple of her clients you might have heard of, Lisa Gardner and Tess Gerritsen. And she was giving us the inside and outs of what an agent does, not only in today's day and age, but how her job has changed tremendously. Because not only has publishing changed, and I just found word yesterday that another publisher was going under called Booktrobe, and that coincides with, we had a couple authors on a couple weeks ago where their publisher was going under, and you're starting to see a little bit more and more of this. I think when more of the self-published authors coming out, a lot of these publishers thought, you know what, I think we can do this. Let's just go get some authors. Let's throw some books out there. We'll make some money. And then they realized it was actually work, and it's a lot more than that. I mean, here at Suspense Publishing, we, of course, you know, we don't publish everybody that sends us books. I mean, that's all we would do, and it would not, you know, there's a lot of books we get that are really just not ready and not worth it, and we're not going to put our name behind something because, like we do with the magazine, we say that these are book recommendations. We don't really have book reviews because we will never post a negative review. That said, if it was a book that we just cannot get into, it's poorly written, we do not like, or it doesn't have good flow or things of that nature, we will just simply write back and say, sorry, we cannot review this because we feel it's not our job. And I've talked about this at length with several companies who think it is their job to go out and trash people's work because they think that it gives them makes them more reputable, that if they trash people's reviews that they're more reputable. And I'm just like, I find it disgusting that people do that in our industry. I find it appalling. I think that they should not be in our industry. And I say it to the face. I mean, I could care less, because it's just not fair that someone sits down, busts their hump for how many hours or years or whatever to create a book, and it finally gets up and it finally gets published, and then somebody sits down there for 4 hours, reads it, and says, I hate it, it's trash, it's garbage, don't read it. Well, if you post negative reviews, I'm not going to read it, because that's one person's opinion. The only time that I'll ever look at a review is if I'm buying a product to see if something works, and I want to hear how somebody used it to see if I'm going to use it that way, and if the things, because some people also post things, and you know, you go to Amazon and they say, oh, this product was terrible, and I can't believe it didn't work, and it's like, yeah, well, you're buying tape and you're trying to, you know, tape up a hose with water and it's going to seep through, so it probably isn't going to work for what you're going to use it for, but that doesn't mean that the product is bad. So you got to look at those things. So that's why we never post negative reviews. We just say these are book recommendations, and if you see them in the magazine, which the latest edition is out now, and if you want a couple free copies, just email over to editor@suspensemagazine.com. I'll shoot it out to you. And that's why we say these are book recommendations. You see them in the magazine. These are books that we say you should be reading if you're a fan of the genre. You can check out, if you're a fan of legal, medical thrillers, whatever you're a fan of, you can check them out, and we got something for you. That's why when we publish books, kind of circle back here, that's why when we publish books, we have decided that, you know, we can't take everything. We take our job very seriously, and we want to make sure that the books that we put out are quality products. So if you do check out Suspense Publishing Authors, you will know that you are finding quality authors, you're finding quality books. It might not be in your genre. It might not be in your field. You might not like military thrillers. You might not like action adventure. You might not like cozies, whatever. But you do know that if you do like those things and you pick up this book, that it's been through the process. And I think that that's what's happened with a lot of publishers, is they felt like, hey, you know, people can self-publish. Well, why don't we just take it out of their hands and we'll do it for them. We'll take a percentage of their sales and then we'll make a lot of money at it. Well, here's the other problem, is that you still need to have a marketing plan. And I'm really thirsty this morning. And you still need to have a marketing plan, and you still need to go out there and be able to market the books. And so if you just think, just by putting it out on Amazon, that people are automatically going to find it and buy it, that's not the case. It's a twofold process. And the process is this, is that, you know, publishers need to do all that they can do to get books into the hands of readers. Now, we're limited in those facts that we can do. And for the simple fact is that it's, you know, you can throw a lot of money. And here's the thing, and I'll tell people, when you don't see a lot of advertisements for books anymore, because there's just not a lot of marketing for it. A lot of publishers no longer have the ability to say, okay, we're going to put, I don't know, a $10,000 marketing campaign behind this book. And if it doesn't work, oh, you know, it's okay. It's only 10 grand and no big deal. The problem is that they do that, you know, 10 times, and now they're into $100,000. Well, $100,000 in today's day and age in the publishing world is a lot of money. So what they're going to do is that unless they really, really feel, and I mean, you really have to feel, and they make mistakes too, just like movies do, when they really feel that this movie's going to hit and they're going to put a lot of marketing behind it, and they're going to make a lot of money, and then it falls flat on the face. Book publishers do the same thing, so they have to be very, very careful with what they will put money behind, and they have to do it very strategically, because books are not movies, and it's not Hollywood. You don't have a three-week hit at the beginning, and then the book goes away. The book is there forever. And you know, we have books that are 20 years old. Paul Kemper Coast still sells very well for having books out 20, 25 years old with his sock books. People are still finding them, and they're still buying them. So smaller publishers will not have a marketing budget to put behind, because let's say that your total budget for the year is $50,000 as a small publisher to market every book you have, and you're going to publish 20. So if you break that down, and we'll just say $20,000 to 20 books, okay, so we can do the math easy. So they got $20,000 budget for the year that they're going to put out, And that can mean a Facebook here or Twitter stuff here or going out to some blog sites or doing some trying to buy some ads in magazines and places like that. That basically is $1,000 they have per book. Now, if they want to spend $5,000 on one book, they have to take it away from another one. And maybe that book doesn't get anything. But if they put $10,000 behind a book, that means half of their other books won't get anything. But that $10,000 better hit, because if it doesn't hit, then they just wasted $10,000. Now 20 of their items are probably not going to sell very well, and they're going to have to rely on the author, which is a very important part, to go out and market their own books. And that's what authors have to do. Because of the fact, and I tell our authors all the time, you know, we very strategically put our money behind our books, but we don't just throw all this money at the very beginning because there's no point at doing that. We have our budget set for the year, and we strategically kind of put them out, and we might have, you know, one or two ads with three or four different titles that all work together, and this and that. That's what we kind of have to do. We can't throw our whole marketing budget behind one book, because if it doesn't take off, well, now there's nothing for anybody else, and that's just not going to work, and you've kind of blown it. But I have seen companies that do that, and that's part of the reason why they do have to close their doors. They just, it's just bad business. They just had bad business decisions when they were doing those things. So that's kind of the behind the scenes of the small publisher, and that's kind of why these publishers are out for a couple years, and they get all these authors going, and then they just kind of fall down by the wayside. They're just no longer around anymore. And now you have a lot of authors that had series that they were tied to, and now these small publishers are out of business, and they don't know whether or not they still have their series or if they can move on forward or go something else. It's a very, very difficult time for them right now. And we're hearing a lot more stories from these people. And I feel for them. And I feel for what's going on in today's day and age, where you do see more and more smaller publishers going away, and even the bigger ones are scaling back. I mean, a lot. You have, I think it's Berkeley Crime, is really cutting back on their cozy titles, I think by almost maybe 50%, if not more. So they're really cutting back. So all those authors who are writing those cozy titles, now they're done. And the only other problem is with that is when you write pretty much a cozy, the author that you see on the book, and I'm not going to say it's 9 times out of 10, I'm just going to say it's a lot when they're writing a series. We have one that Susan Tantangelo, that's actually her real name, writes, and she writes a cozy series for us. But a lot of the time you will see the author's name is not their real name. So you could have someone writing an Italian cooking series under the name, you know, Sue Brown. Well, Sue Brown is an alias, and there could be four people that are writing under the name Sue Brown, because Sue Brown has 10 books out. Well, four people now have written 10 of those books. Maybe somebody wrote the first three, and then somebody else picked up the next two. And so that's the reason why they do use these names, because they can have other people underneath them write these books, and you think it's Sue Brown, but there is no such name as Sue Brown. So now that these cozy authors have to get out from underneath that, no one knows who they are. They might have written five wonderful books under the name Sue Brown, and Sue Brown is the popular one. But now, out from behind that shadow, because they want to continue writing themselves because they've written great books, but now they almost have to start from scratch, because it's not like the other publisher is going to help them out by saying, oh yeah, this is the writer of Sue Brown for the first four bestsellers, and they're not going to do that. So that author has to find how a new audience with their new name, even though they have stuff underneath them. So it's a very weird dichotomy that's going on. I mean, I know someone, a really, really, really good friend of mine right now, is ghostwriting a book for an author. He can't even tell me the name of who it is. But he's ghostwriting a book for an author that's trying to change over into genres. They can't do it very well. They want somebody else to help them out. But you'll never, ever see this person's name on that book. I don't even know what book it is. No idea. but they can never come out and say they wrote that book. So at least in when I wrote my letter from the editor and I was talking about the Dead Man editorial is what some people have now named it. I've gotten some emails on it. Is you have authors like Vince Flynn and Tom Clancy, and you know, you have Mark Greene and you have Grant Blackwood, and those guys are wonderful authors, and they're great authors, and they've done very well being able to write for those brands. But those authors are dead. I mean, Vince and Tom has passed away, and they keep it going on, and it's like, you know, when can you just stop with that? I mean, how many albums does, you know, Tupac have to put out? He, you know, he died, but they're still bringing his stuff out. They say Prince has over 50 albums in his vault that have not been released that are completely finished. Now, are they going to bring those out? I don't know. And that would be great for the, you know, they always make it say it's great for the fans. Well, it's great for the wallet too. I mean, let's not joke around with that. But at least you have Mark's and Grant's name on those books, and with James Patterson and these other people, at least you have those names on the books. You know that at least those guys, Mark Greene has written Tom Clancy. You know he's written it because Tom has died, and so Mark is writing the book. Grant is now, you know, writing a series, and so he's writing the books. So at least you can follow. So if they do, so when Mark comes out with his Gray Man series, you're like, oh, I know Mark. He's the guy who wrote Tom Clancy book. So he has a name. But there's some authors, and there's one gigantic author, and I'm not going to name who it is, but there's one gigantic author that doesn't write his own books. Somebody writes them for him. But you never know it. But you're buying the books because that person's name on it. But they don't write them anymore. And that's the other business that you're having. I mean, I call it the Milli Vanilli of the book industry. You're seeing one thing, but someone else is doing all the work. But the other people are getting the credit. So the person writing the book can never come out and say, you know, hey, I wrote this book. I wrote ABC book, number one bestseller. So why don't you start reading my other stuff because you know I can do it. Can never say that. So they got to start from scratch. So you're getting a lot of that. And I find that, you know, that's really hard for an author. I mean, it's hard for anybody that has to be in that position. Yeah, you got a good check if that's what it's about. If it's about getting a good check and you get that one check because you don't get royalties. You know, don't think that these secondary authors get royalties off the books. They get their check, they go home. That's it. And whatever the book sells, that goes to the estate of the main author on the page. Most of the time, I'm not going to say all the time, I don't know anybody's deals. I know some deals, and I know that that's generally how it works, is you're pretty much paid a hire. I mean, you know, you write it, you get your check, you move on. That's it. You go to the next book. The royalties, you get none of that. Now, you're hoping that if you do want to branch out, people will know your name and you're able to, you know, have a following. But a lot of the times it does not translate that way. And that's sad because, you know, there's some fantastic authors that have written some wonderful books and you read their solo stuff and it's not only, you know, it's just as good as what their stuff was. I mean, you see this with band members too. You know, you have band guys that are going with their bands, and then they jump out with solo stuff. Well, the solo stuff is just as good as the band stuff. It's just not maybe those hits or those things, but a lot of people have done this extremely successful. And, I mean, let's just take one, for instance, you know, George Michael, you know, Wham. Wham was highly successful. George Michael jumps out. He's more successful. Lionel Richie was successful with the Commodores. He jumps out on his own. He's more successful. You know, you can do it if you're known. And that's the part that, you know, you just don't see. So that's kind of like my little rant on that. Just a subject that I've always, you know, I kind of like to get out and kind of talk about and know. And this is just from behind the scenes inside the business that I've seen. And it's kind of the dirty side. And, you know, there is a dirty side. I know that when fans pick up the book and they see it, it's all glamorous. But there is a side that you should know about also. You can't be sheltered from it. You have to know about it, that's what goes on and that's what happens. And it's too bad. But, I mean, that's, you know, John Land always says the best thing in Godfather 2. You know, Michael, this is the profession we have chosen. And you know it kind of going in is that this is what's going to happen when you have this kind of business, and this is the way it's going to be. So what I'm going to do now is I also want to tell you about some of our sponsors here. And I want to make sure that you know that all of the shows here are brought to you by Kensington Books, so make sure you visit kensingtonbooks.com. That's Daniel Palmer with Constant Fear, Kevin O'Brien, The Last Victim, Lisa Jackson, Most Likely to Die, and Mary Burton, Invulnerable. And check out kensingtonbooks.com for more information on those titles along with all the other ones. Janet Cole writes What She Knows, The World of Big Law, Lawyers, and Clients. Her new book is The Mystery, The Smell of Money. And in the book, she pairs a disgruntled law partner with a contract killer having a midlife crisis. They have a common client, an old woman whose ruthlessness includes her need to kill opponents. And when they meet, the killer's next target is the daughter's daughter. So you can find it on Amazon or your local bookstore. Visit Coleslaw, K-O-L-E-Slaw.com. Check out 2015 New Mexico winner for Best Book, Robert Cadera, which was Red Gold. Now his second book in the installment, Get Lost, is out now. So visit Amazon to order that book now. And you like action adventure, you're going to love Robert Cadera. Betty Jean Craig, who was supposed to be on earlier, or they were supposed to be on the show, couldn't make it. We were going to talk about her latest book, so let's mention it. Fairfield's Auction. It's the latest book in her Witherston mystery series. Visit Betty Jean Craig, and that's Craig with an E.com for more information. Also, Crooked Lane Books wants you to know that if you're ready for a thrill, you need to check out their great books, including Leslie Karst and Anna Carlisle, by visiting CrookedLaneBooks.com for more information there. And again, you want to make sure you check out these publishers' websites because you're going to find out a lot of authors that you might not know, and that's how you discover new ones. Impossible to Put Down, says best-selling author Louise Duncan, about Annabelle Lee, which is the latest book by Mike Napa. Visit Coffee, C-O-F-F-E-Y, and HillSeries.com for more information on that. And finally, Jeffrey Deaver and Lee Child agree that Hostage Taker by Stephanie Pintoff is a winner. Suspense Magazine also agrees and put Hostage Taker on the list for one of the best books of 2015. So check it out now by going to Amazon. That's Hostage Taker by Stephanie Pintoff. We're going to take a short break. We're going to be back here with our guest, Claire McIntosh, and we'll see you right on the other side, right after you get a listen to a little, let's do a little Red Rider today, I guess. Here we go. Won't you smile a little? welcome back here to the show. Again, I want to thank you all for listening, however, wherever, and whenever you listen. It's kind of interesting because if you said the next guest was supposed to be Claire McIntosh, I don't know what happened. Today must be a weird day. I don't think it's a full moon, but it could be. Instead, what happened was Carl was supposed to be on at 9:30, but he was told 10 o'clock by his publicist, so he is now waiting on the line. So we're going to get Carl on. Claire must not have had the time right, so she's a little confused, so she's not on. So you know what? We're going to talk with Carl. Claire will probably not be on, and so you know what? We're just going to start it from scratch. You can listen to what I said the first half hour, but now let's start the show here with Carl Brookings and his latest book in his Sean Mystery series, who's a PI out of Minnesota, and the book is called The Case of the Yellow Diamond. So we want to welcome Carl to the show. So Carl, thanks so much for coming on. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me. Even if we do get the times confused sometimes.
Yeah, you know, it's all right. I mean, because I was looking back and I was like, I thought I said 9:30, but you said you heard 10. But that's all right.
Yeah.
You know, we're all good. We're all here. So we'll just
that's
continue
right.
It like nothing ever happened.
That works for me. How are you?
So your latest book is The Case of the Yellow Diamond, came out 2015. It's the latest in your Sean mystery series, who, again, this just came over a couple days ago, so I had to do some research on this. But you have several books under his name. You used to have a series out a while ago back that was a little different. It had a couple other characters, Whitney and
Correct.
Tanner, and then you kind of changed over a little bit. So let's jump into this latest book, The Case of the Yellow Diamond, and then we can kind of work our way back a little bit through your career. So give us the scoop on what you got going on in this book.
Well, the Case of the Yellow Diamond came out of the book before this, which is called The Case of the Purloined Painting, which has to do with something called Monuments Men and the way the Nazis stole a lot of art in during World War II, and how we put a special group together to make it possible to retrieve a lot of that artwork that had been stolen from individuals. Okay, you with me now? All right. In fast forward to the present time, the U.S. Army goes into Baghdad. Instead of protecting the museums as we did during World War II, we stood around and the U.S. Army said, we don't have any orders, and so lots and lots of artifacts were stolen out of the Baghdad museums. Which really irked me. I thought, don't people read history? Don't they know what's going on? Anyway, so out of that, because what were stolen were some jewels. Now, I began to do some research in jewels. I thought, well, you know, there might be a story there. What do I know about diamonds? And it turned out I didn't know anything about diamonds. I didn't know, for example, that the rarest and most expensive diamonds are not the blues and the whites that you get from Africa, but they're the yellows that you get from Southeast Asia. Isn't that interesting?
It
well,
is.
Okay. So then I said, all right, what else is going on? And I contacted a jeweler, and he said, well, I'll tell you an interesting story. He said, at the end of World War II, we were really anxious to get our boys and girls back from the war zones, and so immigration and customs laws and customs inspections were kind of winked at. And so you get 5,000 people on a troop ship showing up in San Francisco Bay, and they process them pretty quickly instead of carefully inspecting duffel bags and things like that. Now, overseas, you know, you got a big war effort, get a lot of people, and some of them are not exactly honest. So they look around, they say, what can I smuggle back besides weapons and swords and flags and things like that? What about something that might be worth some money? Drugs? Well, drugs are bulky. Money's bulky. Oh, look, pebbles. These little pebbles, and you polish them up, and what do you got? Oh, you got diamonds, and they're worth a lot of money. So I'll throw a couple handfuls of these pebbles in the bottom of my duffel bag, and I might lose a few, but I'll get home with a handful of cash. And so that happened to a lot of people. I thought, well, now, you know, there's an interesting premise for a mystery, because a man gets killed in his desk drawer. The cops find these pebbles, and they wonder about those pebbles. and they wonder how they got there. At the same time, my detective, my short detective, gets a visit from a man who lives in White Bear, and the man says, well, here's the deal. We're trying to go to Yap, and we've been going to Yap, and we're snorkelers, and we're divers, and because my wife's great-uncle flew during World War II, and he flew over Yap, which was a command and control center for the Japanese, and I would really like to go, and we want to go and see if we can find the bomber where he was shot down, because it's a fairly shallow bay, and we think it would be interesting to find the airplane that he went down in. That sounds normal, but he said, now, the problem is somebody is sabotaging our efforts. And Sean says, really, number one, he said, I'm not going to Yap. I mean, I don't even go to Edina. I'm not going to Yap. But if it's here, I'll see what I can do. So my detective scoots around and discovers that, indeed, there are people locally who are trying to sabotage Todd's trip to Yap because they don't want him to find the body of her granduncle. And the reason is he might be smuggling uncut diamonds from Southeast Asia to America. And they don't want, the family doesn't want that to happen. So that's, but there are other people involved, which is, that's what I've given you as sort of the tip of the mystery and the motivation for the story.
So you got a couple, what you have is you got a couple layers that are going on with this. Not only do you have the mystery of the murder, but of course then you have the underlying mystery of the murder and why and the who and the how and all the other things that are going on.
Exactly.
Outside of just figuring out who did the killing.
Exactly. That's exactly
so
right.
This sounds like
how does it
so this is one of these throwback, this is like one of maybe the, this is like one of these throwback, you know, 50s and 60s kind of style PI books, I would say, right?
Oh, you noticed. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you want to know why?
Well,
the
I would love
is,
to know why.
Yeah, the reason is this is kind of an homage to a writer named Richard Prather, who wrote a series of books about a detective in Los Angeles. The detective's name was Shel Scott. He was, now listen to the description. He was 6 foot six. He's a former Marine. He'd just as soon shoot you as look at you, and he slept with any woman who walked to the front door. My detective is only 5'2". He only uses a weapon when he absolutely has to, and he doesn't. He's true to the woman he's living with. It's the antithesis, but it's also an homage to Shel Scott and to Richard Prather, who at the time I was reading him, back in the 50s and the 40s, had 20 billion with a B books in print. So I thought it would be fun to give a nod to that kind of success and that kind of book with this short detective who runs around, and that's why.
Now, the question is, now one of the questions that kind of comes up is, why 5'2", though?
Well, because he couldn't be a cop. See that? He
wanted
to be a cop. Couldn't be a cop because he's too short.
I gotcha. Okay.
So that's so, other than that, it's arbitrary.
Okay, all right. Now, the other thing, too, is we have something in common because your books are set in Minnesota. And, you know, like you were mentioning Edina and you mentioned, you know, White Bear Lake and those types of cities, people who might not be from there and want to understand. But Edina is extreme, is one of those older, rich communities that are set in Minneapolis. That's why. So when you kind of mentioned Edina, you know, people have, you know, giving them a little view of, that's kind of like the older, rich kind of, you know, area of Minneapolis. You got some old money, I guess you
that's
want to
correct.
Say that's around that area.
Yeah, it's near Minnetonka, which is the slightly more wealthy area, but it's also right next to St. Louis Park. Now, why do I mention St. Louis Park? Yeah, why do I mention St. Louis Park? Well, because that's where the Coen brothers grew up. You know who the Coen brothers are? Sure. You know, did these movies? Ah, okay.
Well,
so,
and
see,
Vince Flynn is originally from Edina.
Yes, that's right.
So, yeah, and so besides really, and I was sitting here thinking when I saw that you wrote Minnesota Mysteries, I was like, well, besides really John Sanford and Tammy Hoag, I can't really think of another author who really uses Minnesota as a backdrop. For the first thing people hear when they hear Minnesota is, oh, it's got to be cold. But there's a lot of history that goes into Minnesota, especially St. Paul, which was a haven for back in the, you know, Prohibition days, where a lot of the gangsters would go from Chicago and they would take refuge up in St. Paul to kind of get away. A lot of people don't
know
that story.
That's right. That's very true. And there are interesting stories that come out of that. But I'll give you two more authors. William Kent Kruger, who's a New York Times best-selling author, lives in St. Paul.
That's right.
Okay, yeah. See, and Ellen Hart, who has won more awards than there are on this green earth and was named a Princess of the Realm at a recent book conference in New Orleans. So, yeah, we have a number of people up here who write. Some people say it's in the water. I don't know whether it is or not, but the water tastes fine.
It could be in the snow. You never know.
Well, we spend a lot of time indoors in the winter because it's snowing.
Oh yeah, that's when great books come out. And so the reason that I was, you know, kind of asked that too is a lot of times in a lot of these books nowadays that you see, the setting is now becoming its own character. So are you incorporating the style of Minneapolis and the style of the Minnesota nice that people used to call and call that? Are you incorporating that more into your book so people will have this, you know, this newfound maybe love and maybe discover parts of Minnesota that they really had no idea that were even around?
Oh, absolutely. I hope so. I'm trying to do that. I want people to get a flavor of the cities when they go with Sean, even into some nasty situations. Yeah, the restaurants, the special kinds of situations, the lakes and the parks, and all the things that exist for us up here are part and parcel of his existence, and therefore I think need to be part and parcel of the stories. I mean, the stories are fictional, but they're about real people in real places, and I think that's what makes them work.
And it looks like that the case of the greedy lawyers, was that the first time that Sean was that that you introduced him to readers?
That's correct. That was the first story. And
so if
now...
you look back at that story back in 2005, and it says it was reprinted in 2008, and now you're kind of looking ahead now all the way up to 2015 with this latest, the case of the Yellow Diamond, how has Sean as a character maybe evolved, and how has Carl Brookins as a writer evolved through the series?
Well, I think I've become a better writer, but it's really hard to tell. I have to leave that to other people. It's like saying what's your favorite book that you wrote? These are like your children, you know. I can't choose one of them. The next one is my favorite. How's that? One I haven't published yet because I haven't finished writing it. But I think that Sean has become a little more worldly. I think he's branching out. His interests are broadening. He's able to work as a detective, not just in surveillance and in stolen goods and you know, the kind of sort of street-level scuffling around that a lot of private detectives do in real life, but he's becoming more involved in all levels of society. So he can now function as a security guard at a upper-level jewelry display, for example, at one of the posh country clubs. And in fact, that's how this whole thing starts with the case of the purloined of the yellow. The case of the Yellow Diamond. The whole idea of the character growing, I think, is important. The other thing that he's growing, and that he and the woman he lives with, their relationship is deepening and broadening, and she's becoming more and more active in his cases, even though she doesn't like his, she hates guns, so she doesn't let him keep a gun around. But the whole idea then is that the two of them will grow into this function of detecting and solving crimes and helping people. And that I hope that runs out. I might run out of ideas for cases. But I have other ideas. That's not likely. I will be writing cases.
You can always
until
find something.
The day I
but now,
fall over.
But here's the question too, though, because when you do have an idea maybe for a case, or you do have an idea maybe for a book, do they always fit with Sean, or do you kind of maybe have to massage them to make them fit with Sean?
Oh, I'm not abandoning the Adventure Sailing series at all. I have several ideas for that that I'm working on, and I have a couple other characters that keep tapping me on the shoulder and say, write about me. So I, rather than try to massage an idea into a detective story, I would rather take that story and make it a good story on its own and take it wherever it goes, rather than try to fit it under the umbrella of one of my characters. If I need a new character, I'm sure that new character will show up. My door is always open to new characters.
Yeah, and because sometimes I know that I've seen stories, and when I read some series of different books, I kind of have the tendency that it's like, it's almost like they forced this plot on this character, and it kind of was a little clunky. And sometimes I'm like, whether it was a good plot, maybe it would have been a better standalone with a different character, because it just didn't quite
exactly
fit. So I always like to kind of know, hey, when you are an author and you do kind of bring up these ideas, do you have the characters in mind, or is it like, okay, I got this great idea, and it's like, well, maybe it won't work for this character, so I'm going to maybe put it in the back burner because I want to write another book with Sean. So, yeah, I like to see that kind of dynamic.
Yeah. That's exactly my attitude. I have several ideas. Hell, I have a drawer full of ideas for books that I don't have characters for, and I may get characters for them, and I may not. But I would not try to force an idea on a character. And because I think the characters have a lot to say about these things, I don't. They wouldn't let me anyway. And that sounds maybe a little weird, but I don't have writer's block, for example. And people who do, I often say in workshops that I conduct, try getting rid of a character that doesn't seem to be working. Or maybe your problem is that you're trying to get a character to do something that the character knows instinctively is not appropriate. Take that action out. Change that action. Go around them or something. And people will come back and say, it just worked, and everything now is flowing really well. And I really believe that. The characters, there's something mystical about any kind of a creative activity that you're involved in, including writing genre mystery fiction. We're commercial writers. Our whole idea is to write a story that will be popular enough people will buy to make a little money. But it's still a creative process, and it still involves a lot of things that we can't really put our fingers on. Now, I have friends, David Housewright, another good Minnesota writer, writes really good detective stories. Why am I talking about my competitors? Anyway, he insists that he's absolutely in charge. No, he says, nobody in my books does anything that I don't have them do. He said, I don't allow anybody with any ideas to. He said, they don't do that. They don't come to me with ideas. But you see, he said, I don't allow them to use their ideas, which means that in spite of his denials, he does get, at least occasionally, ideas that seem to come from somewhere else. All of our ideas come from somewhere else. I come right down to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you never know where they're going to come from, and they have to come from, you never know where they're going to come from, which is why I really never ask the question to anybody, where do you get your ideas from, or what's your inspiration? I mean, that's a personal thing, and that needs to come from inside. You can't, you're telling me where you're getting your inspiration from is not where somebody else is going to get their inspiration from. So I don't think that those things, those really things coincide. Maybe it's an interesting story, but I think the background of the story itself, to me, is the more interesting part than, you were driving the car one day and all of a sudden you ran a red light and you decided, oh, I'm going to do this story. I mean, it's like, okay.
Well, maybe.
you never know. Now, you're thinking, because it's, for the last couple of books, you've written a book every other year. Is there a reason why that is? Is it just something that just takes you some time, or are you going to speed up the publishing process? How do you think it might look in the future with Sean and your other series?
Well, I'm in the midst of a book about my two Whitney and Tanner characters, another sailing book that I'm working on. I'm also working up the ideas for a couple more Sean books. So it depends. And sometimes I get stuck where I need to do some research. I can't go ahead and just even outline what I'm going to do in the next chapter or the next scene unless I go do some research. So I can't do that research today, but I want to work on the writing, so I'll work on something else. So I have these projects going on together. And I'm not working on a particular schedule. I don't try to get a book out a year. I try to get it when the book. I start at the beginning of a story, you know, and I don't outline when I write the story. When I get to the end of the story, I stop, and then there's lots of revision that goes into it, and that takes time. So there's lots of things going on. Plus, you know, I live a reasonably normal life. When my wife lets me, or when she insists on it, and all of that requires time and takes time, and I'm getting older and slowing down, all these things. So I don't know, you know. But funny things happen. So I may suddenly tomorrow turn around and in a great burst of energy over the summer, turn out the drafts of three or four books. That's been known to happen, but probably won't. You know, I keep working at it. Flexibility,
now,
that's what I like.
And now looking at the series in whole, is this something that people can start wherever they want to? Can they start with the case of the deceiving Don? Can they then jump into maybe reading Hard Cheese? Can they do the case of the great train robbery? How do you kind of suggest they navigate through the series here?
Well, obviously there are some things in the later books that evolve out of understanding of what is going on in the earlier books. This is particularly true of the relationships. The cases are never connected, but I am very careful to be sure that the books are individual books and stand alone. And you won't, other than a couple things, you won't discover anything in the later books that would ruin one of the earlier books for you, let's say, that would destroy the mystery. I don't refer in the later books to the way a case was solved in the earlier books. There are a couple things. I try to avoid always putting my detective at physical risk. I mean, obviously, if there's going to be another book, he's going to have to live. The series is going to go on. He's going to have to stay alive. But anybody else is at risk. And at one point, there was an opportunity for Catherine McKierney, who is Sean's 6'6" girlfriend, to she's only 6'2" actually. There was a situation in which she almost dies, and if you read the later book first, you know that she didn't die. But I never get her quite to death door, so. As I say, you can read Start Anywhere, and if the series intrigues you, then you can go back. You can go backwards or forwards with equal comfort.
Well, I'll tell you what, Carl. We're coming up to the end of the time, so what I want to do is I want to kind of give you the last word to kind of let everybody know where the best places to find out about you and maybe what you got going on here coming up in 2016. So I'll leave it up to you.
Okay, well, I have a website, www.carlbrookins.com. You can buy the books from me. You can buy the books from independent bookstores all over the country. And, of course, they're available online from places like Barnes & Noble and Amazon, all of those kinds of things. And I have a newsletter you can sign up for, all that kind of stuff. So I'm out there actively, pretty much go to libraries and places like that. But the best thing to do is to go to a bookstore, pick up a book, read the synopsis. If you like the book, buy the book. Support our independent bookstores. I think that's important. We're getting more, but that's a good thing. And I'll be seeing you all down the road someplace. And I tell you, you look close, you'll see my actors hanging around with me.
Well, I tell you what, Carl, thank you so much for coming on. It was an absolute pleasure. We got
thank
your time
you for
confused,
me.
But we still got you on, and that's the important thing, right?
Well, I hope you get Claire on sooner or later.
We
and
will,
luck,
and we
guy.
Will have to make that work, too. So it just seems it was just a weird day today, just a little weird day on the radio, but I'm glad it all worked out. So, Bix, wish you nothing but the best for the future, and look forward to maybe talking to you again.
You betcha. Look forward to it. Thanks a lot, John.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care.
So, again, everybody, that is author Carl Brookings. You can go to carlbrookings.com for more information on the latest book, The Case of the Yellow Diamond, the latest in his Sean Sean Mystery series, and you can check out all the other books that he has in his series. Like you said, it's kind of like going back to those kind of 50s and 60s style PI, you know, mystery books where you're going to have that kind of a style. It's not really, you know, the CSI, NCIS kind of stuff that you see out there today. It's more the throwback. So if you're interested in the throwbacks, go out and check out Carl's latest work. Well, like I said, it's been a little bit of a crazy day, but it was good that we were able to get Carl on. Don't forget, Monday is Beyond the Cover. So if you're listening to this before Monday, check out Beyond the Cover, 7:30 p.m. Pacific time, with Star Wars versus Star Trek, the biggest show that we're going to have of the year so far to date with on Beyond the Cover. And if you're listening to this after Monday, then make sure you go back and listen to Beyond the Cover. So until then, everybody, I want to say thanks so much for Carl for coming on. So hopefully we'll get Claire on here sometime soon, too, to be able to talk with her. But until next time, like we always like to say, keep reading. Goodbye, everybody.